we need to.
Yeah, we're gonna get started. So we have, this is 30 minutes.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. Okay, good afternoon, everybody. Today is, City Council will come to order. It is Wednesday, 2 p.m., November 28th, 2012. We're in our afternoon session. Good afternoon, Carla.
Good afternoon.
Could you please call the roll?
Yes. Leonard?
Here.
Fritz?
Here.
Fish?
Here.
Saltzman? Adams.
Here. Quorum is present. We shall proceed. Can you please read the title for time certain ordinance, non-emergency ordinance number 1354?
Delegate authority to write down portions of loans in the Portland Housing Bureau portfolio in order to maintain a sustainable inventory of affordable housing assets and ensure continued public benefit to our community.
Commissioner Nick Fish.
Thank you, Mayor. The way we've structured this is the first half an hour, we're going to deal with residual issues around Washington Park parking. And then we're going to shift into housing because I...
Wishful thinking. Only a half hour?
I heard from a number of you that we just didn't go deep enough. So
I'm going to use my last day of vacation. I'm out of here.
I'd like to begin by inviting Director Tracy Manning, OMF Director Jack Graham, and Karen Williams, honored guests, to come forward. And I have a brief introductory statement. As Mayor and colleagues, as you know, in July of 2010, the merger of the housing functions of the Portland Development Commission and the former Bureau of Housing and Community Development were merged and created the new Portland Housing Bureau. As part of that birth, PDC's $300 million loan portfolio, representing more than two decades of public investments in the city's inventory of affordable housing, was formally transferred to the Portland Housing Bureau in December of 2011. Now, PDC's and the city's housing investments over the last 20 years often filled the financing gaps that nonprofit developers needed to build affordable homes. Our partners are contractually obligated to provide 60 years of affordable rents in exchange for the public investment that we make in the bricks and sticks. Most of these investments historically were made with either tax increment financing dollars or federal dollars, about two-thirds TIF and about one-third federal funds. These weren't typical investments like a home mortgage or a business loan. Some were grants, some were loans, but the general understanding was that the return on the investment was and is the guaranteed affordability. Homes for older adults, people with disabilities, people pulling themselves out of homelessness, and hardworking parents struggling to provide a better life for their children. The investments we have made over the last quarter century have produced an enormous public benefit, which we can all be very proud of. More than 8,000 affordable homes for individuals and families priced out of the private market. But the public benefit of these investments goes well beyond just affordable homes and includes healthy families, stronger, more balanced and vibrant neighborhoods, a welcoming downtown, and frankly, an improved quality of life for all. Now, over the years, this council has supported our important work in a number of ways. By authorizing the city's participation in the HUD Section 108 loan pool, by protecting the community's safety net, by creating and then reaffirming your commitment to the 30% set aside for affordable housing, and by reforming a tax abatement program to provide better value to taxpayers and more strategic investments. Today we're asking for a new tool, one that will allow us to more nimbly manage, Commissioner Leonard, nimbly manage our portfolio. The public benefit is clear. Stronger nonprofit partners and guaranteed long-term affordability for families and individuals across our great city that are unable to make market rate payments. I'm going to turn over the presentation this afternoon to Portland Housing Bureau Director Tracy Manning and our Chief Administrative Officer Jack Graham, and then we'll introduce a special guest. Tracy, take it away.
Yes. Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Council, for your time. We'll try to be direct. It's a little wonky. So as Commissioner Fish referenced, the Bureau, since our merger, has been reviewing our asset management practices, systems, and particularly our housing portfolio and the underlying loans that support it. We manage 1,800 individual loans on about 8,000 rental units throughout the city for low-income individuals and families. And so, at a time of declining resources, preserving existing housing, we've brought to council time and again because we think it's the most effective dollar that we can spend. And like many bureaus, we've been cutting staff. We've cut staff at the Bureau by 30% since we began as a new organization. But at the same time, we've chosen to invest in our asset management staff and systems in order to strengthen the oversight and focus on preservation. Affordable housing is actually a relatively young industry, and we've learned a lot over the last few decades about what it takes to operate and maintain those assets over the long term. We've worked directly with our borrowers in a really positive and dynamic way to review how their buildings and their portfolios are performing financially, as well as to meet their missions in an ongoing way. Overall, the portfolio is performing very well. It's providing safe homes to people who would otherwise be living on the streets and giving families a stable place to grow from. In some cases, we've identified when affordable housing needs a different repayment structure in order to sufficiently invest in maintaining the asset or to provide the staffing that will help the residents be successful. So currently, we use the financial tools approved by council for this restructuring. City Council approved the specific investment vehicles PHB uses when the Bureau was created. Then each year, Council approves our budget for these investments through the regular budget process. And during the course of the year, those individual investments are reviewed by the Housing Investment Committee, which is made up of staff from the Portland Housing Bureau, Office of Management and Finance, PDC, and the City Attorney's Office, and they make a recommendation to me as Bureau Director. Per council direction, those individual investments of up to $2 million are approved by the Bureau Director, up to $3 million by the Commissioner in charge, and then investments over $3 million, those that involve the disposition of city-owned land, or any that are outside of our approved investment vehicles, come before you to City Council, and those are the ones that you see. So right now, all of our council-approved tools are loans of various types. And what we've learned about the portfolio and best practices for maintaining it for the long term, there are a few times when the most effective tool would be to strategically write down a portion of the city-held debt, effectively as if the money had originally been granted to the project or to the nonprofit. So what we propose would be to use this tool at the minimum level necessary to lower the debt load on the building, to sufficiently meet the mission and continue to provide homes for low-income citizens. This tool will allow us to maintain affordable housing without investing additional city cash, which is obviously at a premium. So in the ordinance before you, we're seeking approval for a write-down authority with the following limits: up to $250,000 for the PHB director, $250,000 to $1 million for the PHB director and the OMF chief administrative officer or their designee. $1 million to $2 million would be both the CAO, PHB director, and the commissioner in charge, and then $2 million or more would come to City Council. OMF and PHB do not currently have this option explicitly approved as an investment tool, though it was once used when housing investment was part of PDC. We've done a year-long review as part of our asset management review with OMF, and it indicates that this tool would allow for strategic reinvestment that will help us maintain our assets and guarantee the continued public benefit without negatively impacting the city's financial position. And to say a little bit more about that, I want to both turn over to and thank Chief Administrative Officer Jack Graham, who's been incredibly helpful in helping us analyze this situation.
Thank you, Tracy. Jack Graham, Chief Administrative Officer. Just want to let you know that my staff and I have been working with the Housing Bureau on this proposal, and I'm extremely pleased to be here with Tracy today in support of it. OMF feels that this tool is necessary to help ensure that the Housing Bureau is able to manage its housing portfolio properly. This proposal builds in checks and balances necessary to protect the city's investment in affordable housing buildings and the value that it will continue to provide to the community. This tool is a necessary and a normal function of any lending institution, and we believe that the levels of authority, the approval levels of authorities, which Tracy has outlined, are at the correct levels to ensure accountability. Approval of this tool will have a negligible effect on the city's balance sheets. I, along with OMF team that has been working with the Housing Bureau, endorses this request. And we think that is the right thing to do to continue to have affordable housing in the city of Portland. And so with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Commissioner Fish.
Thank you, Jack. It's now my pleasure to introduce Karen Williams, who I understand Karen's sister is visiting us from Sioux City, Iowa. Welcome. To better understand how this portfolio was assembled and managed, we asked Karen Williams to join us today. Karen, as we all know, has extensive experience in both the public and private sectors. For our purposes, what's really neat is that she previously served as general counsel for the Portland Development Commission, served on the Loan Committee, and today works as a financial and legal advisor for many community development organizations. She's here to help us fill in some of the gaps in our historical understanding of what was done then and why the tool we seek today was not only forecast, but is a prudent continuation of the authority that was once granted to PDC and now to the Housing Bureau. Karen, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Commissioner. Thank you for the invitation. Good afternoon, members of Council. Thank you for your time and attention today. I was personally involved in making many of these early loans at the Portland Development Commission and in structuring and working on the financing that is now actually makes up approximately half of this portfolio, I think. When we were making these early loans at PDC, this affordable housing industry...
Put the mic in front, yeah.
Thank you. Was really an emerging industry. We knew at the time that we didn't have enough information about the operating, maintenance, and capital replacement costs of these projects and how that would compare to the kinds of costs experienced by investment market rate and above owners of rental multifamily rental properties. We knew we didn't understand what the capital replacement schedule would be or how expensive that would be, what the deterioration and replacement rates on these buildings would be. So those are the costs necessary to preserve the building at full utilization, as Tracy and Jack were discussing. We made the decision at the time not to provide for long-term replacement reserves, because if we did, we would have been leaving capital idle in these projects, putting a great deal more public funds into them at the time that they were built, and leaving that capital to sit for years until it was needed for new roofs, HVAC systems, the kinds of things that we think of as capital replacement. We also made, frankly, some guesses about what the operating costs and staffing needs and other kinds of draws on cash flow for these projects would be. At the time, we had such a high need for affordable housing and, of course, few and precious public dollars to invest in it, that we knew that if we put these funds into these projects and left them idle, we would be compromising our ability to use them to build housing at the time. So we set up some of these transactions as recoverable grants, some as loans, but as Tracy so clearly pointed out, the real value of the money in the projects was to get the 60-year affordability that was desired by the city and the stability in the affordable housing inventory. In those early days, we knew we weren't providing for all the future cost of capital maintenance and repairs. But we also knew that there wasn't enough operating history in this industry to know how to do that accurately. And frankly, we didn't want to sequester dollars that were needed to build the housing to be held for some long-term future need. So we knew that some of these issues would come back in 15 to 20 years and that we need to address the issue. We knew the affordable housing industry would normalize, find its most efficient operating structure, and that the portfolio would likely require some adjustments based on that normalized operating history over time. So doing this portfolio cleanup, including some write-downs or conversions to recoverable grants, will ultimately strengthen the housing delivery system in Portland because it results in financial statements for the providers that more accurately reflect their true cash and asset position and their relationship with the city, one of their key lenders. As Jack mentioned, the ability to write down debt is a normal tool for lenders as part of their portfolio and asset management. And I'm pleased now, looking back on the history, to see the city taking up this right-sizing and ability to respond to situations where correcting the portfolio is the right thing to do. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And I have a question.
That's our presentation.
So I appreciate that presentation, in particular the historical perspective you gave as one of the partners in originating some of these loans. So is it fair for the public to conclude, based on what we've heard here today, that when we were making these loans originally, we weren't really sure what the playing field would look like, what the operating expenses would be, and what our real goal was not so much to make a loan to seek repayment, but to provide housing for people who otherwise couldn't afford housing. And at this point, what we're recognizing is some of those payments are better used, repayments would be better used to improve the infrastructure, to do maintenance that, of course, has to be done on buildings and structures that people live in. So we've made a judgment that it's a better use of those dollars to reinvest them into the housing units, to keep them in housing and also do the improvements necessary to sustain that program.
I think that's an eloquent restatement of exactly the point and a nice clear understanding of it.
Thank you.
If I could just piggyback off of that, because through this process I've learned a lot. My colleagues will remember that in some of the major investments of TIF we've made in the last few years, we've done them as grant money, where we've put the money in. But our leverage in terms of ensuring long-term affordability was in a separate agreement. The difference 20 years ago is that, in addition to all the things that have been identified, loans gave us an additional tool to ensure compliance with our covenants.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, in some cases, we actually did make loans. Let's be clear. I mean, we're not recharacterizing things now as not loans that were loans. There were some that were perhaps clearly loans. But when you're looking at a 60-year horizon, you're saying, how can we best ensure that we get compliance with our long-term affordability goals? A loan is a pretty good inducement because it's a lien on the property, and it gets people's attention. More recently, we've learned that we can also have the appropriate kinds of carrots and sticks through grants, where we don't have to structure as a loan, but we put money in. And in fact, if I'm not mistaken, the $30 million we put into Bud Clark Commons was a grant and not a loan. In our discussions, we've never had people from the public come and criticize us for using one over the other. Mm-hmm. What's consistent, we've heard from the advocates, make darn sure that we get the public benefit. Mm-hmm. Because people understood this is different than investing in a business, investing in a private home, making an investment per se. The investment was in a public asset. Really, in some ways, no different than investing in streets and sidewalks and other things. It's just structured differently. But the public benefit was the 60 years of affordability. And we've gotten more sophisticated in how to structure deals so it doesn't have to be debt in order to make sure that we get the faithful commitment to 60 years of affordability. But I appreciate the way you frame that, Randy.
So my understanding is that this is a tool of last resort and that there's various other processes that owners can go through before this. That's correct, right?
Yeah, I think I wouldn't always characterize it as last resort. I think there's opportunity at times for additional leverage. So a nonprofit borrower, if we use this tool, could go out and bring private dollars to the building because you'd create some collateral there that would actually be invested in that public benefit. And so in that case, I wouldn't necessarily call it last resort, but we would weigh what the greatest public benefit is. In most cases, we would use other kinds of restructuring that would leave the full amount as a lien against the building.
And Tracy, let me just add one comment on that, because I think you touched on a really important point. Sometimes the perception is that the reason you need this tool is that someone's in distress and needs to be, in effect, the problem needs to be addressed and fixed. As Karen noted, this could actually be a tool that's applied to a very high-performing partner whose balance sheet has just got too much debt in it and is not able currently, with historically low interest rates, to go out to the private markets to refinance the way you and I might by refinancing our homes to get to free up some money to fix the roof. They may not be able to do that unless we take a little debt off the balance sheet. Mm-hmm. But what we'll get in return is we'll bring some private debt in and new capital to be used to fix the roof, make the building better for the long term without our partner coming to the city council and asking for an appropriation. And that's the magic of this approach.
This is a clear and objective, and there's a transparent and accountable process for going through this, correct?
Yeah, so the process is the same as our original debt. So all of our borrowers report on all of their properties to us every year, operating revenue and expenses against the original pro forma that was included with the loan. So based on that annual reporting, either the borrower or PHB could initiate the need for a restructure. Staff would review those annual statements, again, against the original agreement, make a recommendation to the Housing Investment Committee, which includes OMF staff, city attorney staff, PDC staff, our staff. And then based on HICS review, make a recommendation to me, and then we go through the waterfall of approvals based on the size of the approval or the size of the requested adjustment, who had the approval. And then annually, we'll report back to council on all of the activity against those actions.
And to your commission as well, presumably.
Oh, yeah. We report to the commissioner with great frequency.
To the Citizen Advisory Committee Commission.
Are overseen by the Portland Housing Advisory Commission.
Right.
Yes.
And they would get the report before it comes to council, presumably.
Simultaneously or, yeah.
And then just one final question. What do we have in place in our current process for approving loans that takes into account this issue of maintenance and ongoing expenses of a new property?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
A new loan that we would, and I heard what Commissioner Fish said, and sometimes we just choose to do a grant, making it very clear that then the ownership responsibility and the ongoing maintenance. But in the situation where we would choose to give a loan to a housing provider, what's in place to avoid the deferred maintenance building up and
can I state a recurrence of this? Slightly differently, because it's the key question. What have you as an organization learned previously that you're putting into practice today with your loans going forward?
That's a nice reframing. Thank you.
Oh, we've learned a lot. One of the great things about our system, one of the great benefits is also one of the challenges, which is we have a lot of borrowers that provide a lot of different products to the community, people that house people coming right out of the street, right out of treatment, right out of a medical facility, and people that are housing large families that are perhaps saving for home ownership. So what we've developed, we work with our private lending partners quite extensively, with our borrowers, with other affordable housing industry throughout the country, and developed what we consider to be ranges of operating expenses that make sense for the product that the borrower has agreed to deliver. And so using those ranges in our current underwriting, the new loans, we've developed guidelines that will allow the borrower to have a healthy building going forward. We try to allow for some contingencies so that if something happens, last decade it was utility prices that went up more than projection, we've got some cushion to be able to manage that. We can't manage for every contingency, and as Karen, I think, did a good job of pointing out, it would probably not be a good idea to try to put a bunch of cash away up front, but I believe we have come a very long way in learning what it takes.
So for issues, as the example was given of replacing the roof every 20 years, is that now included in the calculations up front?
It is. Thank you for highlighting much more succinctly what I should have said up front. Yes, we have a line item for replacement reserves, which are designed specifically to pay for capital items like roofs, like furnaces that need replacing over a longer term.
Thank you.
All right. Is anyone signed up to testify? Thank you all very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
No one else signed up.
Does anyone wish to testify that did not sign up?
Mayor, since this goes to a second reading, may I just make an observation before
Sure.
we go? Because a lot of the people that are here won't be joining us next week. I want to take this moment to thank Jack, Tracy, and Karen for the time and effort they put into helping us work this through. In particular, I want to thank Jack and his team at OMF, Rich Goward, others. This is, we've only had this portfolio since 2011, and there's an enormous amount of complexity when you transfer over a portfolio that's over $300 million, over nearly 2,000 loans, and we're trying to sync it up. And I really appreciate the professionalism and the teamwork and, frankly, the tough questions and oversight to make sure we're on the right track. So thank you to Karen, who joined the team to give us a historical perspective and give us a little primer on what people were thinking 20 years ago in particular. Thank you. I also want to just acknowledge a number of other people. Jacob Fox, who is here, who played a leadership role, our deputy director, Rich Goward, who I mentioned, Amy Edwards, who's our super consultant, who is way down in the weeds looking at all of these portfolio issues, and particularly in connection with the computer system that we will have fully up and online shortly. Javier Mena, who's here, who is who to me represents in his team this commitment, renewed commitment the Bureau has made to asset management. The reality is we're going to have fewer dollars going forward to do new development, for better or worse, and it didn't turn exclusively on who the next president is going to be. There's just fewer dollars in the pipeline at every level of government. So as we shift from being more focused on development to preservation and asset management, our organization has shifted. And we're putting more resources into being the best possible stewards of what we have. And that, by the way, is consistent with what the auditor has said in two audits, across the board, urging us to focus on being the best stewards of our existing assets. So I want to thank the whole team. I want to particularly thank Sonia Schmansky, Shemansky of my team. Sonia, raise your hand, will you? She's an unsung hero on this and has worked tirelessly. Danielle Ledesma, Jamie, the whole team, thank you all for going the extra mile. And to my colleagues, assuming we have your support next week, this is just another tool. This is not a game changer, but this is another tool, and you have given us a variety of tools to be good custodians and stewards of this portfolio. We think this is an additional tool which will help us create a sustainable portfolio for the next 50 years, and most importantly, will allow us to do so without having to come seek general fund or direct support. Banks, all kinds of institutions are doing this. We want the same authority, and with following close consultation with my colleagues, I think we hit the right sweet spots in terms of what you're comfortable with in allocating discretion, as Tracy says, up the waterfall, and then ultimately the kinds of accountability you'd like to see annually so that we can see how this tool was used and what the public benefit was. So I just want to thank this terrific team because this is a 30-minute presentation, but a lot of time went into getting this right. So thank you all very much.
Thank you. Thank you for the presentation. The council will consider it further next week. Carla, can you please read two companion items, a report contained in item 1355 and a emergency ordinance contained in 1356.
1355, accept report on Title 13, Nature in Neighborhoods, request for Metro determination of substantial compliance. 1356, direct the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability Director to submit request for Metro determination of substantial compliance with Title 13, Nature and Neighborhoods, and establish a voluntary intergovernmental agreement with Metro as a statement of intent to continue watershed health-related efforts and collaboration.
So this is a recommendation coming to us from the Planning and Sustainability Commission. Title 13 is the Regional Urban Growth Management Functional Plan, also titled Nature in the Neighborhoods, that establishes minimum requirements to preserve, conserve, and restore regionally significant riparian corridors and wildlife habitat. It was adopted by Metro in 2005. In terms of our compliance, Metro granted the City of Portland two extensions to 2009 to the compliance deadlines. The extensions provided time for the city to progress on key projects that would update policies and protections for Title 13 habitat conservation areas in Portland. The last extension ended June 30th, 2012. So we're going to hear today the recommendations from Planning and Sustainability Commission and consider them for action. Mr. Zender.
Well, good afternoon, Commissioners. I'm Joe Zender with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. And Title 13 compliance is an important milestone for the city. Portland collaborated closely with Metro and other jurisdictions throughout the development of Title 13, and as a result, it actually mirrors Portland's approaches to conserve and enhance our natural resources. Today, with our Bureau partners, we're bringing to you a holistic package that clearly meets and we believe exceeds Metro's requirements for natural resource protection. The Planning and Sustainability Commission agreed and voted unanimously to endorse this compliance package. What we are asking is that, in addition to submittal of the package, that the City Council authorize voluntary intergovernmental agreement between the City and Metro. This intergovernmental agreement is to send a clear message that while Portland is in compliance with Title 13, the work on natural resources and sustaining watershed health is not done. It contains the programs and projects that the city knows it's going to undertake or wishes to continue to undertake in that realm. The IGA also recognizes that all of that work is subject to City Council direction and future budget decisions, but it's our statement of intent in regards to continuing the work on Title 13. So today for our presentation, Roberta Jortner, who's the lead planner for putting together the package, will lead you through the contents of what our compliance report includes. And then we have brief comments from the Director of Bureau of Environmental Services, Dean Marriott, and the Director of Parks and Recreation, Mike Abate, on their parts of the IGA. Also comments by Mike Halk on behalf of the Planning and Sustainability Commission and Tim O'Brien from Metro. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Okay, we're live. Good afternoon. Today's presentation will provide a brief orientation to Title 13 and a summary of the compliance package. Then we'll go over the IGA and
Could you get the mic a little closer to you?
Sure. Is that good?
I think so.
Is that good enough?
That's even better.
All right. As the mayor noted, Title 13 was adopted in 2005 after extensive public review and analysis by Metro and a number of other parties. And the main goal is to provide a contiguous integrated corridor of riparian areas and to protect water quality. The habitat conservation areas the mayor referred to are waterways, floodplains, wetlands, and vegetated areas, and they provide multiple benefits. They reduce hazard risks and increase resiliency to climate change. They cool and clean our air and water, and they provide important habitat for people as well as fish and wildlife. This map shows the 19,000 or so acres of Title 13 habitat conservation areas in Portland. Cities and counties can comply using regulations, non-regulatory programs, and area-specific tools. Title 13 prioritizes avoiding impacts on these resources first and then mitigating unavoidable impacts. Title 13 also balances goals for environmental quality and for economic development by establishing more stringent requirements for the highest value resource areas and more moderate requirements for resource areas within high development areas like prime industrial land. As the mayor said, the city asked for more time, and I just want to recognize that during these extension periods, this council adopted a number of projects that significantly expanded and enriched the city's environmental protections and will also enhance the urban forest. And the city has also provided strategic policy direction through the Portland Plan for improving watershed health and achieving goals, setting the stage for the comprehensive plan update. And the city also made great progress on planning for West Hayden Island and the central and north reaches of the Willamette River. And as we know, those will continue into the future. So now we're ready to ask Metro to find Portland in substantial compliance with Title 13 based on a mix of existing programs. No new regulations are proposed as part of this package.
Is that a local bird?
That is a killdeer in the Columbia Slough watershed. Yes.
I've seen it. It's beautiful.
What's it called? It's a killdeer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They also found.
See you later, Commissioner Houck.
They also recently found.
All for it.
He actually made the call.
They also recently found killdeer and nesting killdeer in the reservoir up at Powell Butte, the new reservoir up in Powell Butte.
Ooh.
In or on?
What?
In or on?
Gonna have to shut that project
in,
down.
In the whole, they actually did modify their project to really? Protect the nests.
Are they endangered?
You did
no,
not need to
they're not.
That.
Sorry, they're not going to shut that.
This is a tangent. So, you know, there's no definition for substantial compliance, and so Metro looks at each submittal and decides whether it's adequate. So each local program is unique. This request applies to lands within the city currently and specified portions of Multnomah County. It does not apply to West Hayden Island, and if the city annexes West Hayden Island, the city will submit a separate request later. So now a quick summary of the proposal. A key element of the package is a new and improved natural resources inventory that council adopted last month to help inform the comprehensive plan update. This inventory builds on Metro's work and incorporates more current data, scientific studies, fieldwork, and technical review. The city's environmental, greenway, scenic, and Pleasant Valley overlay zones provide the foundation for this compliance request and are administered by the Bureau of Development Services, and Rachel Whiteside is also here on behalf of BDS to help field any questions. These overlay zones meet basic Title 13 requirements to limit disturbance on natural resources and require mitigation and or resource enhancement. And like Title 13, these overlay zones balance goals for the environment and development, and they vary in stringency depending on where you are. So here again is the map of Title 13 habitat conservation areas in Portland. And this map, the pink areas show the overlay zones combined. They apply to over 90% of the habitat conservation areas and an additional almost 3,000 areas of natural resources outside the Title 13 HCAs, including upland resource areas that Title 13 doesn't address. Most of the resources not currently within these overlay zones do have some protections through other city or state regulations or are in public ownership and are not at risk of development. Other city zoning tools support Title 13 by addressing natural resources and hazards on land division sites, applying area-specific resource protections in plan districts, and establishing natural resource management plans for valuable areas like Forest Park, Smith and Bybee Wetlands, and other areas in the Columbia Slough. The city's Title 13 compliance package includes non-zoning regulations, including stormwater, drainage reserve, erosion control, and floodplain rules that apply to all new development and several pollution enforcement programs. And as mentioned, the council recently updated the city's invasive plant rules and overhauled the city's tree codes, which address Title 13 priorities. Portland meets Title 13 habitat-friendly development requirements by encouraging the use of pervious pavement, shared driveways, and narrower streets to limit impervious area, low-impact stream crossings, and road undercrossings for wildlife passage and bird-friendly building design, and other practices as well. Non-regulatory programs are featured in the compliance package, too. These programs are administered largely by the Bureaus of Environmental Services and Parks and Recreation. The city's willing seller land acquisition, natural area management, and watershed revegetation programs protect public health and safety, address regulatory requirements, and are actively preserving, maintaining, and restoring thousands of acres of city-managed and privately owned land. And this photo at the lower portion of the screen is of the recent purchase at Riverview Cemetery. This photo is the same site after one season of treatment for removal of English ivy and other invasive plants. It's pretty
chemicals?
Remarkable.
Their removal is with chemicals?
It's a combination of mechanical means and strategic application of herbicides. It's the typical approach.
Impressive.
Using green infrastructure approaches and most currently through the Greater Green Initiative, the city is weaving nature into the built environment by planting thousands of trees, installing vegetative green street facilities, replacing culverts, and providing incentives to plant trees and install eco-roofs. And the city is working with diverse partners on innovative confluence restoration projects and infrastructure projects like Tabor to the River, which I believe Dean Marriott will touch on in his remarks. The city provides grants, training, and education to support local watershed councils, neighborhood organizations, residents, and businesses. And these partnerships generate thousands of volunteer hours a year to help improve watershed conditions. And finally, the city's actively monitoring watershed conditions using a new coordinated approach that will allow us to track trends, prioritize investments, and provide the best chances for success. As Joe noted, while Title 13 is an important accomplishment, the city has a ways to go to meet its watershed health goals, and both the city and metro face a number of challenging issues. To confirm our intent to continue watershed-related efforts and collaboration, the city and metro proposed to enter into a voluntary agreement. This was also strongly supported by the Planning and Sustainability Commission and other stakeholders that testified at that hearing. The IGA would go into effect when metro finds the city in compliance with Title 13, hopefully next month, and would last for 10 years. And the city would periodically report on progress. Specifically, the IGA affirms Portland's commitment to update the comprehensive plan and Willamette Greenway plan, decide on whether or not to annex West Hayden Island, and pursue a holistic planning effort for the Columbia Corridor. The IGA confirms the city's intent to seek funding for the implementation of new tree codes and continue ongoing watershed restoration programs that we've just gone over. And the IGA highlights opportunities for collaboration between the city and metro, including setting priorities for future natural area acquisition and maintenance, identifying ecologically sensitive industrial design opportunities, determining strategies to meet goals for jobs and the environment, and strategizing on how to address emerging federal rules to meet Endangered Species Act requirements in the floodplain. The Planning and Sustainability Commission unanimously recommended council accept this report. And also, we'd like the council to authorize staff to make minor edits and updates, including a few typos and pieces when we put the report together from Metro. And the recommendation is also to approve the ordinance authorizing the Planning and Sustainability Director to submit the request to Metro and the directors of Planning and Sustainability, Environmental Services, and Parks to sign the agreement on behalf of the city. We've gotten two written testimony so far, one from Bonnie McKnight, supporting the compliance request and IGA with particular emphasis on moving forward with the Columbia Corridor planning effort and the tree project. And just a few minutes ago, I handed to Carla an email from Linda Robinson to the council, also in support of the compliance proposal and the IGA to confirm ongoing commitment to our watersheds.
So with that, we'll turn it over to our invited speakers.
Great. We have three people signed up, or is that in addition to our invited speakers? Oh, invited speakers first. Director Abate, Director Marriott, Commissioner Houck.
Mayor Adams, I've asked Director Abate to answer any questions that were still left from this morning on Washington Park parking.
Absolutely. I have a list of like 50.
Great.
50. I have 52 questions, but I'll save them later. Who would like to go first?
Here you go. Good afternoon, Mayor Adams, members of the council, Dean Marriott, Environmental Services Director. First of all, let me say that it's a pleasure for us to have collaborated so closely with planning, parks, and the other bureaus. This is a good example of how well the bureaus can work together. As you know, Environmental Services is focused on protecting and restoring watershed health, recognizing that watersheds are critical to providing clean water and fantastic habitat to the people of Portland. Now, our watershed management plan that was adopted by the City Council and our other watershed health efforts align very well with Title 13. Natural resources such as streams, wetlands, forests are valuable for their habitat functions as well as providing a sound and healthy ecosystem. But in many parts of Portland, our streams are actually part of our city's infrastructure. They manage stormwater. They take stormwater from places that have, the stormwater has no other place to go. We depend on these resources to provide clean water for people and wildlife and to protect our endangered species and to avoid flooding and landslide impacts when the stormwater has no other place to go. Now, Roberta mentioned just a minute ago Tabor to the River. This is something that I know the council is very familiar with. We are committed to using green infrastructure where it makes sense and is cost-effective, and one of the best examples we have is right here in southeast, right across the river in southeast Portland, where our efforts to provide stormwater and sewer service to the neighborhoods around Mount Tabor, doing it in a green way is really saving the ratepayers about $60 million over the life of that project. So we've shown that it's good for the environment and it's good for our pocketbook as well. We hope to be able to continue these kinds of investments going forward into the future, so we look forward to that. And one of the important things for us is watersheds don't necessarily respect political jurisdictions. So as an example, in Johnson Creek, about 60% of Johnson Creek is outside of Portland, but what goes on outside of Portland, obviously, in that watershed affects our citizens and ratepayers. So Metro doing this on a regional basis is very helpful to the people of Portland. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Abate.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor and members of council. Mike Abate, Portland Parks and Recreation. And Parks and Rec is pleased to have played several roles in Title 13 compliance. Nature and neighborhoods is a key part of our core mission. Healthy parks, healthy Portland starts with a healthy landscape. We manage over 8,000 acres of natural areas for habitat and watershed health while providing access to nature for thousands, if not millions, of Portland residents and visitors. In the past year, Park City Nature staff has worked with volunteers who provided over 56,000 hours of stewardship effort in our park natural areas, enhancing and restoring city's forests and wetlands. And I think it's significant to recognize our citizens who have seriously adopted this as part of their ethic of living in the city. Our Protect the Best crew, in partnership with BES, has treated over 3,000 acres of invasive plants within parks' natural areas since 2007 to improve wildlife, habitat, and watershed health. In fiscal year 12-13, the current one, the Protect the Best crew will treat 200 new acres and retreat about 650. We've been a partner with Metro, allocating over 50% of the local share pass-through dollars from the 2006 natural areas bond measure to the acquisition of natural areas within the city. And we've acquired over 300 acres of additional natural areas with those funds. Portland Parks also has the responsibility for our city's urban forest, and we're working with partner agencies and community organizations to attain the goals laid out in the Urban Forest Management Plan of 2004, the Urban Forest Action Plan of 2008, and the 2012 Portland Plan. A recent study showed that, unlike many other cities, Portland actually has increased its tree canopy in the last 10 years, especially in residential and commercial zones. And we're currently preparing for implementation of the citywide tree project and a package of code and process revisions to further protect urban forest. So as Dean mentioned, we appreciate that the natural world doesn't respect political boundaries, and so partnerships with our regional partners are key to the success of this, and we're pleased to play that role. And so I'm pleased to sign this agreement indicating our intent to continue these programs on behalf of Parks and Rec.
Thank you. Mike?
My name is Mike Houck. I do serve on the Planning and Sustainability Commission. I was asked to represent the commission at this hearing. Normally, our chair, Andre Baugh, would be here. I think I was asked primarily to provide a little historical and contextual perspective in that 32 years ago, I started working on Goal 5 inventories in the region out in Washington County and then eventually the city of Portland. When I started that work, by the way, I was told that there was no place for nature in the city, that the land use planning program was to protect nature outside the UGB and everything inside was up for grabs. Well, over the intervening 30 years, we've come to recognize that protection, restoration, and management of natural resources is essential to quality of life, maintaining biodiversity, ecosystem health, healthy watersheds, and a healthy economy. And I'm proud to say Portland has taken a leadership role in that effort, and today's hearing is one more step regarding Portland's leadership in the metropolitan region. In the late 1980s, a number of us went to Metro realizing that we were getting very uneven protection of natural areas across the metropolitan region. And out of that effort in the late 80s came two initiatives. One was the Metropolitan Green Spaces Initiative, which resulted in the passage of two bond measures, which raised $363 million and has resulted, along with the City of Portland and Metro and other local park providers, adding 16,000 acres of natural areas to the public land base. The other initiative was a regulatory approach, which was Title III, which was adopted in 1998, which addressed water quality and hazard lands. And then in 2005, as you've heard, Metro passed Title 13 statewide, which addresses fish and wildlife habitat, statewide Goal 5. 7 years later, we're here asking that you approve the city's application to Metro indicating compliance with Title 13. You do have a letter of transmittal of conveyance from the Planning and Sustainability Commission. The only thing I'll reference in this letter, I won't read it, you've got a copy of it, is that we considered the IGA as key to meeting compliance with Title 13. And as you heard earlier, I think Joe mentioned that Title 13 established minimum environmental standards, and it was anticipated that in addition to those minimal regulatory standards, that there would be a plethora of other both regulatory and non-regulatory approaches that would result in better protection, restoration, and management of the city and the region's natural resources. I do want to point out one thing that's of great concern. The Planning and Sustainability Commission has made it clear that we're hopeful we can align the budget process with the Portland Plan, achieving the objectives of the Portland Plan, and we feel this similarly with this objective or with this package. Under city obligations, it does say, notwithstanding any other provision of this agreement, the city's ability to implement projects and programs outlined in Section 1 is contingent on funding availability in the City Council's appropriation of funds. So the Planning and Sustainability Commission is definitely interested in you taking a look at this IGA and the other programs that need to be implemented and thinking that in terms of the budget process. I'll close by saying that under the joint obligations between Metro and the city, and it's absolutely true that the city continues to play a huge leadership role in this region with regard to natural resources. That Metro and the city have agreed to address green infrastructure and ecosystem services in local and regional decision making, integrating parks, trails, and natural areas and habitat-friendly development design and practices and land use planning, improve watershed functions, and mitigate and adapt to climate change. And I'll just simply say that while the city has taken a huge role in getting us to compliance with Title 13, Bureau of Environmental Services in particular and Portland Parks and Recreation in particular have both also contributed at the regional level in developing a regional conservation strategy. And I brought copies of the executive summary for you today. This is another huge monumental step, I think, in terms of both addressing the need to protect, restore, and manage natural areas in the city, but also region-wide. And the city can take huge pride in the fact that it was the contributions of city staff that resulted in the production of these documents. There's actually two full documents available online at theintertwinedalliance.org. And we appreciate the city's leadership in the regional level as well as at the City of Portland.
Question for Commissioner Houck. Was there discussion at the Planning Sustainability Commission about making the IGA more specific, particularly with providing protection for the 5 to 10% unprotected lands?
Well, we spent quite a bit of time going over IGA details and actually did recommend some additions to the IGA, so I feel comfortable that we've address those issues.
So the references to the comprehensive plan and then the specifics in the comprehensive plan, work plan, that's incorporated by reference in
Correct.
This IGA?
Yes.
Thank you. So that would also cover Bonnie McKnight's concern about the Columbia Corridor.
Correct. That was actually brought up at the Planning Sustainability Commission hearing, as
and
a matter of fact.
And my understanding of what's in the Portland plan, which you know far better from being on the commission, is that the timelines are not necessarily set in stone either. So when something, for instance, the Columbia Corridor plan says after the Willamette Greenway plan is completed, that could be changed as part of the comprehensive plan work.
Correct.
Thank you.
In fact, it's stated explicitly that priorities may change over time as well. So there's definitely flexibility. As you know, the IGA is voluntary. But the important thing was that it did point out those areas in which the city would continue to address natural resource issues.
Thank you.
Hi, welcome.
Hi. Good afternoon, Mayor Adams and Commissioners. Tim O'Brien, Metro Planning Department, 600 Northeast Grand Avenue, Portland, 97232. I just have a few additional comments to highlight some of the points that Roberta made in her presentation, as well as the testimony from the other bureaus. As Roberta noted, we've been working on this for the last few years, and I'm very pleased that we've finally made it to this stage. As noted previously, the two compliance extensions the city received allowed staff to complete a number of projects that bolster the city's habitat protection program, and it gets us to our current proposal, which we believe is in substantial compliance with Title 13. Compliance with Title 13 is not one-size-fits-all process. We acknowledge that individual cities or counties are in different situations, and we work with them to try to, on an individual basis, to come up with a protection-level program that meets their needs, and it meets the intent of Title 13. Compliance is not a numbers game or a strict quantitative analysis. We look at the overall programs a jurisdiction implements to meet the intent of Title 13. When the Metro Council adopted Title 13, it specifically noted that comprehensive approach would include voluntary, incentive-based, educational, and regulatory elements. The determination of substantial compliance is for the city as a whole and not on individual portions of the overall program. The determination of substantial compliance is made at the Metro staff level, and it does not go to before the Metro Council. Once staff makes their determination, a letter is sent to the city indicating that you are in substantial compliance. And in addition, Metro does complete a compliance report by March 1st of each year that provides the status of compliance with all the titles of the functional plan for each jurisdiction in the region. As Roberta also pointed out, the city's protection program is multifaceted and covers a wide range of actions and programs, from overlay zones to plan districts, development regulations, restoration, acquisition, the green streets, and education stewardship programs. And I really feel this is the kind of program the Metro Council envisioned when they created Nature Neighborhoods, as many of these elements align directly with actions Metro is itself implementing. The number of diverse programs and projects the city has put into actions by far